Welcome to Political Rewind. I hope you all had a wonderful 4th of July. I thought about the fact last night that, you know, it's been a while now since the legislature made all fireworks legal. But, you know, like a lot of these things, it kicks in slowly. And I noticed last night my neighborhood was exploding like never before for so long that I'm thinking, we got to talk to the legislature. Beth Shapiro is with us. You're nodding. You have the same issue in your neighborhood?
Yes. Our puppy and I would love to revisit this with the legislature after 4 nights of fireworks.
I think like the big fireworks company in Georgia, and I, not to give them a plug, is Phantom Fireworks. And I think people have really discovered them. And Eric Tanblatt's here, too. You're nodding, but it was the same in your neighborhood.
Like your puppy, my dog was going crazy.
Andy, okay, wait a minute. Let me start it over again. Beth Shapiro, of course, we're so glad to have you back. It's been too long. So thank you for being with
us. Glad to be back.
Beth is a now retired pollster and political consultant, often working with Democratic candidates. Also did a lot of corporate work in her consulting and polling business. Eric Tanblatt, of course, I think one of the best-known non-elected official Republicans in the state of Georgia. He's worked with Republicans on from local races all the way up to President of the United States. Eric, it's great to have you here
today.
He's also the head of the political practice for Dentons, the world's largest law firm. No wonder you can't be here as often as we used to be able to get you here.
I always find time.
Good, good. And I'm really glad Andy Miller could join us today. He, of course, is the editor of Georgia Health News. There's really nobody who tracks health care issues with the depth of understanding that Andy Miller brings to the table. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here,
Bill. As well, Andy. Did you have firework trouble in your neighborhood?
Yeah, but my wife and I just turned the sound up on the TV.
Oh, I just turned down the sound of my hearing aids.
And what did your dog do?
Our dogs didn't have a problem, but that's another matter. All right, so we're going to talk about health care today with Andy because he knows so much about the subject. Because although the Senate is in recess right now, they're coming back next week, and we understand, you know, the leader, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, seems to have every intention of bringing the bill back up, looking for the 50-plus votes that he needs to get this thing across. A little later in the show, we're going to talk a bit about President Trump visiting the G20. He's going to have his first meeting with Vladimir Putin. Our Twitter question today was, one thing you want President Trump to say to Putin. Tweet us that, and we'll read some of your tweets on the air. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the latest in the war between the Trump administration and the media. But let's start with healthcare. Andy, can you take us through, just in as concise a way as possible, how different is the Senate bill from the House bill, and where are the big differences between the two?
Well, first of all, the Senate Republicans were saying, we're going to start from scratch. We're going to start all over. You know, we can forget about the House bill. But really, they're very similar in a lot of ways. For one thing, the individual mandate for people to get insurance, that's gone in each of those bills, both the House and the Senate, as well as the mandate for employers to cover their employees with health care. So those things are very similar. Now, what the Senate bill does that's different from the House is it preserves what's going on with pre-existing conditions that the ACA has. The House had more wiggle room for the states to kind of go away from that and craft their own kind of high-risk pools and allow insurers, you know, to rate up and to charge people with these health conditions more. But the Senate has basically stayed with the ACA on that. And it's similar in some ways to how it handles Medicaid. The federal funding under each of these bills is going to be capped. It's different, the formulas that they use, but essentially what states are going to get is a limited amount of federal dollars. It's now no longer going to be an entitlement program. States can take this money as a block grant and do what they want to in terms of eligibility and benefits and things like that. And they both get rid of Medicaid expansion, which we know that the Georgia has not, is one of 19 states that didn't do Medicaid expansion. And both bills do that. And both bills allow states, in terms of private insurance, to remove the some or all, or, you know, most of or some of these essential 10 essential health benefits. Mm-hmm. So a state could get a waiver under each of these bills so that insurance companies can say, okay, well, we're not going to cover something like maternity or prescription drugs.
Emergency room care is one of those, I believe.
Mental health care, yeah. Substance abuse, and things like that. So they're similar in many ways. There are a few differences, but they're basically very similar.
So I think, Beth and Eric, let me work you into the conversation. Of the things that Andy mentioned to us, a couple of big ones that are creating some controversy on the Hill and creating some problems. Number one is the rollback of Medicaid. The fact that both the House and the Senate bill, but the Senate bill, I think, accelerates it. Is that right, Andy?
Well, it does something on expansion that's a little bit different,
right.
Where the House bill would allow people who are getting Medicaid expansion, those adults, to keep it beyond the cutoff date. In other words, they can't be kicked off Medicaid expansion, where the Senate doesn't do that. In other words, they cut the money off
right.
at whatever year it
okay.
is, and then, you know, it's every state
so
to themselves.
Clearly, that has been an issue of enormous controversy among some moderate Republicans, but also the Democrats are up in arms about that.
Yeah. Well, and I think it also has to do with the states. I mean, there are a number of states that did do the Medicaid expansion, and, you know, they're having to deal with, you know, what to do when this if this bill gets enacted. And that's why you're seeing some pushback from, you know, the Democrats don't surprise me because this unfortunately has become partisan. But from some of the more moderate Republicans or Republicans in states that did the Medicaid expansion.
I think that to go back to even before we start talking about specifics, I think that the Republican Party has a huge optics problem with this because we're talking about healthcare components. What the Republican Party presented both in the House and Senate versions is not a healthcare bill; it's a tax reform and deficit reduction bill. And that's how this bill was presented. Oh, we're repealing Obamacare and we're going to knock $321 billion off the deficit and we're going to return taxes back to higher income people. And not a word of what was presented initially was about health care. And I think what's certainly what's distressing to Democrats and to perhaps moderates of both parties is that there's not really a conversation about what's the role of government, whether it's federal or state, in ensuring that Americans are able to access health care and to be healthy citizens. And I think we'll argue over the details of these two specific bills, but kind of lost in all this is the fact that we're not really talking about healthcare policy. We're talking about allocation and reallocation of
federal
dollars.
I don't necessarily know that I agree with you, and I'm not surprised that that's your view. But what the Republicans are doing is they're repealing a flawed law. I mean, you can look at what's going on all across the country with premiums that are going up. With some states where there's not even a choice, where providers are pulling out, insurance companies are pulling out. So what the Republicans are faced with is they're having to deal with a flawed law, repealing that, and then replacing it with something. And this bill, this legislation, both what passed the House and what's pending in the Senate, is not the only thing they're going to do. I mean, Secretary Price has made that perfectly clear, that this is a staged process. This is just the first part, the first stage in a three-stage process.
So, but when something is flawed, you don't need to throw the entire baby out with the bathwater. And I think that there are Democrats agree that there are things that need fixing about it. And so our approach would be to work on fixing as opposed to...
Yeah, the problem is the Democrats aren't willing partners. They don't want to participate.
That's not true. I think that there are Democrats who are willing. There are Democrats who are currently speaking with Republicans and looking for ways to come up with something that works.
I want to jump in because I want to pick up on something that you said when you began talking about this, Beth, and I want to turn to you on this, Andy. And we can go all the way back to the ACA, to Obamacare, when Democrats introduced that legislation. Now, while I know it's true that once Obamacare was on the table, Democrats did hold hearings, committee meetings. There was a process. Now, in the long run, they took it private. They went secret at the end to try to get the details worked out. But I think Beth raises an interesting question that I think you're well-equipped to help us with. Has there ever been, even if you go back to the beginnings of ACA, a reasonable conversation in Washington about exactly what the government's role ought to be in providing health care to the American people? The starting point for both the ACA and this measure are, well, we're going to figure out some way to give you some insurance, maybe not as much as you need, maybe too much. Talk about that a little.
Well, health care reform, getting people insurance, goes way back to Harry Truman. And the well-known liberal Richard Nixon actually said we need to do some kind of national health care plan. So this has been out there for a long time. And it gets to the fact of what you believe government should do. As you say, should government help people afford insurance or give insurance to people, or should it be private market? The only problem with the private market handling is that's not the way the system works now. I mean, half of the dollars in healthcare are spent by government programs like Medicaid and Medicare. And so I'll respond a little bit to what Eric had to say and Beth is the fact that insurance companies now are facing a big problem because what they're getting from the current administration is mixed messages about whether they're going to get these subsidies to help people afford insurance, whether the federal government's even going to help them market these plans. And so it's a reason why many insurance companies have pulled out or are thinking of pulling out, including Blue Cross of Georgia. They're in it right now, but they could always pull out. And if they don't get more certain signs from this administration, they may just pull out of Georgia.
So, all right. So, I'm still not sure that we've ever had a conversation under current political circumstances about whether the government really does belong in health care or not. And Eric, I would think there are some Republicans who think the government shouldn't be in health care.
The problem is this has been political since when President Obama,
well,
got
that
the
was
affordable.
My point. Yeah,
and he passed this law. There were a lot of things that he said or other Democratic leaders said, you can keep your plan as is. Well, then we found out that wasn't the case. And so for the last 8 years, we've been litigating this law that was put in 8 years ago that you couldn't have a meaningful debate. And, some will say President Trump got elected because of the failure of government to do what they said they were going to do. So we haven't had a healthy debate on this issue.
Yeah.
I don't want to make this overly partisan, but I think in defense...
Go ahead.
All right. Let me roll up my sleeveless shirt and sleeves. And in defense of Obama and the Democrats, when the ACA was first proposed, there was an attempt to bring Republicans along. But apparently early on in the Obama administration was when the Republican Party determined that we're not going to give him a win on anything. And it became impossible for the Democratic Party to find, for their president, President Obama, to find Republicans who would be supportive, even just of conversations about how to shape it. So I think that what came out was a law that there wasn't universal support for it because there wasn't universal input into it. And again, I think, yes, there are things that are flawed about it, but they can, I think we need to figure out a way to fix that.
All right. So we know that we're going to have the Senate come back and we know that McConnell wants to pass this bill. What are the sticking points, Andy? Where is he going to have to figure out some compromises?
Well, he's got to figure out how to to meld the Rand Paul, Ted Cruz conservative wing of the party with the more centrist part of the party.
Rand Paul's position has been all along. Wait, I thought we were repealing Obamacare.
Yeah, I mean, get rid of the whole thing.
Get rid of it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. With the more centrist people that are like John Kasich, for example.
Susan Collins,
yep. Exactly. Dean Heller of Nevada. And to patch those two together in this kind of a workable thing is going to be very difficult. You're really going to have to thread the needle. Oh, this is an unpopular law as it stands now with just like...
The bill.
The bill with 12 to 20% of Americans supporting it. So Republicans are going to have a tough choice. Are they going to renege on their promise to repeal Obamacare? And Eric says no. Or are they going to pass an unpopular bill?
Yeah, and I want to, okay, that's right. That does seem to be the Gordian knot that Mitch McConnell and his Republican conference is going to have to really wrestle with untangling in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, and I'm optimistic. I think that there's a lot of posturing going on right now. I think if you take some of the members you mentioned, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, you know, watch them, because I think what they do is sending a signal to the House Freedom Caucus members. And some of it is posturing during this period of time. If you remember back when the House was debating the bill, there was a 3-week period from when Speaker Ryan pulled the bill to when it actually passed. There was a foreign trip. The president went overseas. They came back and lo and behold, they had a bill and they had the votes to get it. I think there's a lot of backroom dealing that's going on. There's a lot of conversations with both the moderates and the conservatives. And I think after all of this, when Congress comes back in session, you're going to see them pass it.
I'm going to lob the biggest, fattest softball you've ever had thrown to you in your life.
I'm ready.
Based on what we're talking about here, the Republicans are in a bind. They either fulfill a campaign pledge or they reject a bill that isn't really all that great for the American people. Are Republicans perhaps on the verge of passing a bill that is not in the best interest of the American people simply to fulfill a campaign promise?
It appears that way. I'll let Eric tell if that's true. I think what will be interesting is, they've been talking for 7 years about repealing and replacing, and I would have assumed that during those 7 years they might have had time to come up with a plan other than in that crammed 3-week period in the House and the crammed week or two in the Senate that we've seen this year. But I think what will be interesting will be in the detail, the implementation details, and in the at what point different pieces get phased in. Because my understanding of the Senate bill with Medicaid funding in particular is that the worst impact won't start to be felt until early in the 2020s, long after the next presidential election, long after a couple of more election cycles for Congress. So what I fully expect is that we'll have a repeal. The Republicans will repeal this. What they replace it with will be something where the worst things get phased in over time, and it won't be until a few years down the road that people realize just how bad the bill
is. I don't think the Republicans are going to follow the Democratic playbook as you just described. I think they're going to pass a law where they're going to repeal it and they're going to replace it with something that's better, that's going to lower premiums, that's going to give patients choice. And I don't think we're going to have the games that you're just describing.
I'm not sure we're going to see lower premiums. I mean, I've covered healthcare for a long time. Premiums never go down. They always go up. And the CBO is projecting like...
Slowing the growth. Maybe that's the better way to say it.
Slowing the growth.
Slowing the growth of
premiums. But as the premiums will go up the next couple of years, 20% and 10%, they will, the growth will slow. But a lot of that will be because there will be a lot of people not in the market anymore. They'll be uninsured. And there will be a lot of plans, health plans being sold that are less generous or less full of benefits in the future if this law passes.
Because we have you here, I want to walk through that just a little bit more. Right. Okay, so both the House and the Senate bills repeal the individual mandate, the Obamacare bill, which requires you buy insurance. Because you eliminate the individual mandate, you take money out of the insurance pool, because even healthy people presumably had to buy health insurance, contribute money to the pool, which is why for the first couple of years under whatever bill Republicans plan to pass, premiums are going to go up because insurance companies are going to have to cover the costs of people who are no longer in the market, at least for the first couple of years. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Young, healthy people won't have that stick to face in terms of should I buy insurance
right.
or not, because,
right.
you know, and they'll, many of them will decide, hey, I don't need this. I'm invincible. I can, you know, I'm not going to get sick.
Or they may just buy a catastrophic plan.
And Eric Tannenblatt, we're going to have to take a break. You get the last question before the break. The rates, if this bill, a version of these bills pass, these rates are going to start going up just in time for the 2018 off-year election. That is not an enviable position for Republicans to be in.
No, but the Republicans are going to, they're going to uphold the word that they gave to the American people that they're going to fix this.
All right. You got the last word before we take a break. We're going to come back. We have a few more questions I want to ask you all to weigh in terms of health care. And then we'll move on to some other really, really interesting stuff going on in politics this week. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
We're back. Andy Miller of Georgia Health News, Republican Eric Tannenblatt, and Democrat Beth Shapiro join us. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. I suggested that one of the questions, or that the question we'd love to have you answer is, of course, Putin and Trump meet on Friday morning, the first time the two of them will get together in person. And so I said, tell us, what's the one thing that President Trump should say to Putin? Danielle Ross says, you are being watched. So am I. Sad. That's a great tweet, Danielle. Thank you for that. We've had a number of tweets about the health care plan. Richard Boder says, please bring up single payer universal Medicare. It is more popular than Trump care, which is at 17%, or Obamacare. Barbara S. says, if GOP had acted like grownups in the first place and helped with crafting the ACA, we wouldn't be in this predicament that we're in now. So let's go ahead and talk about, single payer. Bernie Sanders is on single payer again. He's pushing it hard again. We've talked about it on the show before, but it's good to be reminded. Andy, single payer essentially means the government is the insurer for everybody, right?
Medicare for everybody. And the talking point for people is, look, Medicare is an extremely popular government program. I mean, there's nobody will come up to you and say, we'll really have a whole bevy of complaints about it versus what's happening out there in the private insurance world. It's also one of those things where government would take over and pay all the bills and supposedly maybe negotiate with the drug companies to get better prices for drugs. It would cost a lot of money, clearly. It seems that there are a lot of people who think if at the end of the day, if Obamacare collapses, if the GOP plan collapses, we have many more uninsured people, hospitals go out of business, that might be the entrance to actually talking about single payer is a possibility.
It's a long, long, long way from happening, isn't it, Beth and Eric?
I think so. I think that there's a lot that's attractive about it. I will admit to part of my age and that I am on Medicare, and I think that in many respects it's a program that does work well. But I do think that one component of it that people may not like is that there are many providers who choose not to be on it because government reimbursements are not the same as what they get from private insurers, which comes back to the whole way that we pay for health care in this country to begin with. But I think it's certainly something that's worth investigating, because what we have now is not working for a lot of people.
I think what this discussion demonstrates is how complicated our healthcare system is.
Who knew
healthcare
could be
so
complicated?
When he first was inaugurated. I forget who that was.
I think it's the same guy who said yesterday, here, I want to introduce the second lady, Mike Pence's wife. I never heard that before. All right. Okay. So I want to take issue with one thing, Beth. I want to call you out on this. You're saying that Democrats have expressed interest in working with Republicans on health care. Now, I do think it's certainly true that Mitch McConnell has not opened the door wide and said, please, let's work together on this. But isn't the reality that we are so entrenched in our partisan foxholes that there is no way to come together and work on these issues?
If that's the case, we all should just give it up and go home. I hope that we're not at that point yet. I do think that there are still plenty of Democrats, and I think that there are still some Republicans who are willing to work with the other side. So you forget that the Democrats actually believe in government. We believe that government can play a positive role in people's lives. And the Republican Party used to have people that accepted a part of that, but their base is just so far off to the right in terms of being anti-government that it's hard to find Republican moderates who Eric is about to jump off.
Well, actually, I want to reframe this.
But,
yeah, go ahead.
But I do think that there are, and I'm drawing a complete blank. I know that Lisa Murkowski, and there's at least one Democratic senator. She's been Lisa Murkowski, Republican from Alaska. There's at least one Democratic senator she's been talking with. I read another pair. Senator Cassidy from Louisiana, Republican from Louisiana, has been talking with a Democratic senator. Again, I'm drawing a blank on the two names, but no, I think there are.
She can't remember the Democrats' names.
Know.
Oh, Beth,
you know,
she remembered the Republicans.
I know. Well, that's because they stand out.
Right.
You know, actually, it was Mayor Tomlinson who was on your show last week or a couple of weeks ago, who said, you know what you need to do is you get three Democratic women senators and three Republican women senators in a room, and they're going to get the problem solved because that's where there's been bipartisanship on, particularly
right,
on healthcare
right.
issues.
I want to jump ahead. Andy, what's our good Georgia friend Tom Price's role in all this at this point?
Well, he's saying that he reacted to Trump's tweet, I guess, to say, you know, we'll repeal and then replace down the road. I mean, he said, he kind of moved away from that tweet. You know, they want to get
involved,
a deal done.
To the best of your knowledge?
I've got to believe he is. And it's interesting, in the Senate bill is better for Georgia as a state in terms of Medicaid funding than the House is. And I wonder if Tom Price had something to do with that.
Interesting. I'll tell you what. I brought up Tom Price in part because he had a rocky time on Meet the Press on Sunday with Chuck Todd. Todd pressing him. And some of the questions we're talking about here, are Republicans really going to be able to pass anything on this show? Eric Tanenblatt says yes. But let's listen to how that conversation devolved and the way it ended up between Price and Todd.
This is really remarkable. You got incredible challenges across this nation, incredible challenges around the world. The challenge that I've been given is to address the health care issues. And your program, a program with the incredible history of Meet the Press, and that's what you want to talk about?
I don't.
Let me just suggest to you that the American people want to talk about the challenges.
I'm asking Mr. Secretary, with all due respect, you're blaming me for what the President of the United States has spent his entire week focused on?
No. Listen to me. With all due respect, the American people are concerned about a health care system that is not providing choices, where premiums are going up, where there are insurance companies vacating markets all across this land, and that's what they want us to concentrate on, that's what they want us to fix, and that's what I and the President are working on.
Why isn't the President devoted to this as you are?
Oh, I think that he is.
Okay, I really should have set that up for you. I apologize I didn't. Chuck Todd moved from the healthcare question to asking Price how he felt about the Trump Twitter war against Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, and that's what ensued. But What do you make of hearing that kind of exchange between those two?
I think this president makes it very difficult for his cabinet members to defend him. And I don't know what else there is to say.
Well, I think Secretary Price is correct in that the American people don't really care about issues like, you know, the tweets and Mika Brzezinski. The media is obsessed with everything this president does that deals with tweets and insulting people, and the media is choosing what to report on. And, you know, Tom Price is right. The American people are concerned about their premiums going up or not having health care, and they want to see our political leaders, you know, fix the system.
Andy, can the go ahead, you weigh in.
I actually think the media has done a lot of work on health care recently. The big newspapers, the TV shows, I think they've really tried to focus on what this bill would mean to the average American. And as we said, health care is complicated, but I think we have really done a pretty good job, and we're still trying to do it. And remember, there are no public hearings on this bill, so we're trying to do it through reading the clauses of the bill and talking to experts and things like that. But I think we've tackled this.
Do you think, as you've watched this unfold, do you agree with the critics who say that President Trump is hurting the cause, not helping it? And there is an extent to which Washington Post had a big piece on this the other day, that the president has not been as engaged as many Republicans on the Hill wish he would be. He did spend several days talking about Morning Joe. Is he helping?
Well, I think yes and no. I think he's really calling a lot of these senators to try to get them to move to a yes on this bill. But on the other hand, he did come off by calling the House bill mean, and you know, at one point. And he's also, you know, talking about let's just repeal and maybe replace down the road, which kind of undercuts the Senate Republicans trying to get something done, I think.
And he doesn't, presidents don't get into the weeds. I mean, that's what the legislators do. And the legislators are working out all of the different issues that they have to work out. And I don't think it should be expected that the president's going to get into the fine details.
But I think you can expect that the president won't be attempting to distract us from the fact that there isn't a health care bill that's got majority Republican support at this point. Which is what I think is, which is why I and many others think that he gets into these Twitter wars with whomever. That those are distracting tactics, and I think that given that the White House communication staff has said that tweeting is a way that the president communicates with the American public, I don't know how you can expect the media not to report on what he's tweeting. So I think you that he is his own worst enemy in many ways, but. Until he learns to control himself, I think we'll continue to see him engage in Twitter wars and undermine the House bill or undermine legislation with unhelpful adjectives.
Before we leave healthcare, Andy, I want you to, if you would, help us on one news story that was reported just yesterday. Isaacson and Perdue, Senator Johnny Isaacson and Senator David Perdue, have a proposal they're trying to get before, get McConnell to look at seriously that has an impact here on Georgia. Do you want to help us with that?
Yeah, for states, Bill, that didn't expand Medicaid, there are 19, including Georgia. What they would like to see, our senators would like to see, is more indigent care money going to safety net hospitals in these states that didn't expand, in the 19 states. And that would help offset, you know, the number of uninsured that these hospitals are caring for. They also are trying to exempt children who have medically complex conditions from the Medicaid overhaul that's in the bill right now. And so both of those things would be helpful to Georgia, and this is what they're working on.
And this is a great example of the kinds of things that are happening, not just with the two Georgia senators. It's happening with senators all across the country.
All right, you know what? Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way and move on from our healthcare discussion. By the way, I noticed, you know, I don't think anybody who's home on recess has had a town meeting that I'm aware of, none of our members. And I noticed Eric David Perdue decided he'd rather be in Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan with Senator Elizabeth Warren. That tells you
and
how,
John McCain and
how
Lindsey
far
Graham.
Away he wants to be from his constituents.
No, that's it just like, shows that he's in a bipartisan spirit here.
That's
that
kind of like
promoting.
Having Representative John Lewis and Senator Ted Cruz off on a trip together.
Just having a little fun at their expense. Let's take another break and come back and continue our conversation.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rick Wortsman, author of the new book, The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. It's about the erosion of the social contract between employer and employee. We'll also hear from Sharon Horgan, co-creator and star of the Amazon comedy series, Catastrophe. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Beth Shapiro, Eric Tannenblatt, Andy Miller at the in the studio today. Let me hit on a couple of quick Georgia issues and then move on to other matters. Eric, I want you to comment on what you just said during the break. Talking about, it picks up on this theme of possible bipartisanship. You went to Washington to see Congresswoman Handel sworn in a week ago, and you were struck by what?
Well, I was struck by the fact that it was a bipartisan event. Congressman Lewis introduced her on the floor of the House, followed by Congressman Graves. You had the entire delegation, except for Congressman Johnson, who were all there. David Scott was sitting in the front row. Congresswoman Handel delivered her speech, and there was a lot of hugging and Democrats, Republicans, and it just showed that. In certain times, you could put the partisanship aside and do what's
John
in the best
Lewis
interest.
Gave really lovely remarks about Handel. It may be the last time he says anything about her that is as nice as it was that day, because the partisanship will undoubtedly kick in. But
I will say, having worked for a Georgia senator, one thing about the Georgia congressional delegation is they do all come together and put the state first when there are issues, and we have a history of that in the state.
One other quick thing. We talked about it on this show on Friday, but I think I'm not sure we got into it the way that we can. We're not going to be able to today. But just briefly, the request by we talked briefly about the fact that Brian Kemp, Secretary of State Kemp and gubernatorial candidate Kemp, have decided to comply with the Trump administration's this task force that's looking at election integrity and send to that commission voter data. Now, none of it is private. It's all what's publicly available, last four numbers of Social Security numbers. But what's interesting about this is the overwhelming number of states, Republican as well as Democrats, like Louisiana, Alabama, that absolutely have refused to send their data. I find that to be a little bit surprising. Anybody?
Well, Secretary of State Kemp is running for governor next year, and I think he's, from what I'm reading, is trying to appeal to Trump voters in Georgia. And so he doesn't want to look as if he's in opposition to the president, and would not respond the way I think the Secretary of State of Kentucky responded, that all the bourbon in Kentucky wouldn't force her to send that to Washington. So I think he's trying to walk a fine line of, well, what I'm sending them is already out in the public record, but I'm not going to send them any more than that. But it's still disturbing. Not what Secretary Kemp is doing, but what the president is doing through this commission that's investigating alleged voter fraud, and in the process, trying to collect records of every voter in the country. I think that's something that we all, Democrats and Republicans, ought to be concerned about.
Yeah, and I think just a point of clarification, I think what Secretary Kemp is doing is he's basically responding by providing information that anyone can get.
Right.
So he's not sending more information than...
No, that's exactly right.
Issue of voter fraud, I think, has been pretty much debunked by most reports and investigations of this in states. I mean, I know that the president said, hey, 3 million people voted illegally and all that sort of stuff. But I think over the years we've found that there's been very, very little evidence that, people vote twice or vote improperly.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think that's the underlying question. And I'd like to, at some point on this show, do a deeper dive into that. Brian Kemp did say, though, that in regards to voter integrity, he thinks that the real problem is the mainstream media's obsession with tales of Moscow's attempts to influence our elections. He had an op-ed piece in USA Today, said misinformation from the media or disgruntled partisans not only fuels conspiracy theorists, but also erodes the first safeguard we have in our elections, the public's trust. Failing to respect this process with accurate reporting is a disservice to the American people. So, Beth, you said he's running as a Trump candidate. He certainly is, even to the extent of questioning any Russian involvement in trying to disrupt our election process.
Well, I put a little more faith in what the FBI has reported on Russian hacking and their hacking into the voting record, voting networks in 21 states. I put a little more faith in what former Director Comey would say than Secretary of State Kemp.
It was really fascinating that he decided to go there. And we'll be talking about the governor's race in a lot more depth, but I didn't want to let an opportunity to look at that pass us by. All right, let's take a big leap forward with the few minutes that we have left. We know that just this week, North Korea has tested another rocket, and this time it is a genuine ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile, which means that given the opportunity to develop a nuclear warhead, they now can hit the United States. James Stavridis, who, of course, was a former retired admiral, was in charge of troops in NATO, in Western Europe, excuse me. He was interviewed about just where he thinks we're going with North Korea and this dilemma that the administration has in figuring out how to respond. And he gave a rather chilling answer.
It will be on President Trump's watch to make this decision, and it becomes a preemptive strike that is legitimate under international law. We'd want to build an Asian coalition. You want Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, as many as you can get on board. And you're going to have to use a combination of cyber, special forces, and you're going to have to use long-range air from Guam, as well as bring 3 to 4 carrier battle groups around the peninsula. We're going to lose hundreds of thousands of people in that scenario. Many of them will be Americans. There are 200,000 American citizens there. It's a very dark scenario, but if you've got to lance the boil militarily, can you do it? Yes. Do you have the legitimacy to do it when the nuke and the intercontinental missile streams cross? Yes, that's probably 18 months away.
Eric, chilling.
It is. It is. And this is very scary. And I think it's going to be a test of the president's leadership. And fortunately, he's got a good team around him when it comes to foreign affairs and dealing with the military. General Mattis, McMaster, the Secretary of State, Tillerson. I think that, you know, this is an issue that is going to require a great deal of thought. And this is not going to be a shoot from the hip decision.
So let me throw this out to all of you. You know, the one area, I mean, obviously the president has been under an enormous amount of criticism. One of the areas where he's been getting credit is that he has let loose a bit on the reins of the military. He's allowed his military leaders to make decisions about where to engage, where not to engage. And for the most part, this seems to have worked fairly well. The President Obama, his administration, took every decision into their own quarters, made it themselves. So now the question becomes, Beth, you're ready to see the president turn his military loose in finding a solution for Korea? Are you more worried that he may get involved?
Well, I think that there are no good options there. I'm certainly no expert, but from a little bit I've read, there really are no good options. And I would agree with Eric's assessment. I think that there are some very smart knowledgeable, level-headed people around him, and I hope that he's turning to these experts for guidance.
Yeah, the military, as Eric said, you know, these people with military background, Mattis and McMaster, you know, that's you know, they would know, they would be able to project what does this mean for our troops if we get involved here, and that will be a check on kind of a preemptive strike or something like that. That they will have the experience. Hopefully, they do have the experience, and hopefully, that will convey that to the president. These are our options, and this is what we can and can't do in this situation.
The president has been tweeting about this. He early this morning tweeted. Trade between China and North Korea grew almost 40% in the first quarter. So much for China working with us, but we had to give it a try. The president thought that he could encourage the Chinese to intercede to get, since they are the biggest trading partner, North Korea is our biggest trading partner, and he now seems to be giving up on that, although he's heading off. He's in Europe now. He headed off to the G20 this morning, and among the conversations he's going to have are conversations with the Chinese leadership about what to do in North Korea. So we're going to watch that. He also meets on Friday morning with Vladimir Putin. All right, so I'll ask you the question that we've asked people to tweet us. Beth Shapiro, what's the one thing that President Trump should say to Vladimir Putin when they meet?
I'm going to paraphrase Harrison Ford from Air Force One,
yeah.
Which all of us have seen a million times, where he throws the hijacker off the plane and he says, "Get off of my plane." So if I'm the president speaking to Vladimir Putin, I would say, "Get out of our elections."
Eric, you got an idea of what he ought to tell him?
No, I don't have an idea, but I think he does have to make it clear that he has to, whatever he says, has to demonstrate strength, and that America remains strong, and send a signal to Putin.
You know, in some ways, Andy, he's in a box.
He is, but he absolutely, I think, needs to convey the fact that we don't want any more of this interference in our elections. This happened, and it needs to stop.
But again, he has refused to acknowledge that there is. He sort of said in a glancing way, "Maybe, oh yeah, I guess maybe Russia's involved." So the question becomes, how does he all of a sudden say to Putin, "Stop interfering with elections. I didn't know that you were involved with him in the first place." You know.
Well, that's true, but I mean, I'm sure there'll be conversations off the record, away from people like the media, where he can say. I mean, hopefully he will say that.
All right.
And I'm not sure that's the first thing that they're going to talk about. I mean, right now this situation in Korea is probably a lot, and what's going on in Syria. And so there's a host of issues for them to discuss.
Absolutely. You're completely correct. All right. Listen, we're just about out of time for today's show, but I want to take a little time to talk to you about what's coming up on both Political Rewind and on our show, Two-Way Street. Political Rewind on Friday should be pretty interesting. Jim Galloway will be here. And joining us, among our other panelists, will be the former Democratic candidate for governor, Jason Carter. He chose not to run again this time around, but that certainly doesn't mean that Jason Carter is not involved in politics, and he certainly will be involved in Democratic politics as this election approaches. What does he think Democrats can suddenly do to turn the tide, the red tide that has controlled Georgia for so long? We will talk to him about that on Friday. Chip Lake, Republican strategist, will be here on Friday as well. Then on Monday, we have a really special show for you. You hear all this talk about, oh, this Trump and Russia, it's just like Watergate. Well, we all know it's not really just like Watergate. So we thought it'd be a good time to go back and take a look at the history of Watergate with somebody who knew it well. Richard Benveniste will be our guest. He was special prosecutor during the Watergate trials. He was involved specifically in all of the cover-up activity. And we've recorded our conversation with him already, and I have to tell you, I don't think you want to miss that show, because his reminders about what it was like to be in Watergate back then and how he does see similarities and dissimilarities to what is happening right now is pretty interesting. That's Monday at 2. So finally, I want to take just a minute more to remind you that If you have not been listening to our show, Two-Way Street, which is aired on Saturday afternoons and Sunday mornings, we tomorrow go on the air for the first time during the week. We're going to be on Thursdays at 2 p.m. with new shows. If you're one of those who's listened to the Sunday rebroadcast at 11, that'll continue. But starting tomorrow, we're with you every Thursday afternoon. And for those of you who don't listen, Two-Way Street's all about creative people, whether they are authors, artists of various kinds, performers, chefs, scientists doing fascinating research, telling good stories. And we start tomorrow with a show with, I think, one of America's, in some cases, most beloved, in another case, his most despised, because he's played heroes and villains, Alan Alda. He's written a book that talks about how he's learning, helping scientists learn how to communicate better by teaching them the acting games that he played coming up in his experiences. And he tells us that it was an experience with a dentist that got him on this role to try to help scientists communicate better. Here's just a little from that show.
And then a couple of weeks later, I was making a movie, and I was supposed to smile in a scene. And after the shot, the cameraman came over and said, I thought you were going to smile. You were sneering. I said, no, I was smiling. He said, no. To look in the mirror, you got a sneer on your face. And he had given me a smilectomy, and I didn't know what had happened.
Yeah, he cut your frenum, which is not something I ever knew about.
I didn't know much about it either. He then, when I told him that I needed my face to smile sometimes because I made a living out of my face, he said he sent me a letter that was totally directed at getting me not to sue him. It was a legal defense. And I thought, this guy is compounding his lack of connection to me.
So that's Alan Alda, who will be with us at 2 o'clock tomorrow to talk about his life as an actor. Does he watch MASH reruns when he comes across them? We'll talk about that on that show. So I hope you join us for Two-Way Street now every Thursday at 2. In the meantime, Andy Miller from Georgia Health News, it's a real pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime healthcare is on the table, we want you here to help us understand it.
Be glad to do it.
Eric Tannenblatt, it's a pleasure to have you back with us. Thank you for being here. And Beth Shapiro, thank you. Bring your puppy in next time. You know, we're a dog-friendly building here at Georgia Public Broadcasting.
She would love to be here.
All right. My thanks to our staff. Excuse me. Olivia Reingold, Jenny Ahmed, Tyler Morris, Lisa Clark. Appreciate all the work you do to get this show on the air. I'm Bill Nigut. Be back with you again Friday at 3 and tomorrow at 2 on Two-Way Street.